This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's time to talk about fish disappearing from the sea. No, not global warming this time or sewage pollution. I mean the fishing industrial complex. It grabs whole species for our dinner tables and other places that you might not expect. We're going to chat with one of the new generation of marine scientists, Jennifer Jacquette. She's an American now working on her PhD. Well, actually, she's got her PhD in Canada. She's part of the Sea Around Us project at the University of British Columbia. Jennifer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
You've hit the newspapers lately as the lead author of a new study on our declining fisheries. Where are all the fish going?
A lot of them are going to the human appetite one way or another. Most fish that we take out of the ocean, we use to feed to ourselves or something we eat. And that's, I think, what you were referring to, the very bizarre use of fish meal in pig and poultry production in addition to farm fish production. So it's a very strange market.
Well, why do they do it? They get these great big giant nets. They fill up huge trawlers or whatever, and then they get it and grind it all up and feed it to land animals that normally wouldn't eat that. Why are they doing it?
They're doing it for two reasons. One, it's cheap, and two, it's a protein source, so they can grow those animals like pigs and chickens more quickly on this very like high protein rich source of fish meal. And like I said, that's it's cheap because a lot of that fish meal is coming from the developing world, places like Peru, where they're catching these very small fish that really the humans could be eating themselves but aren't, because there seems to be higher demand from farm.
Is it sustainable? Can we keep doing this?
No, it's not sustainable, and it's definitely a waste. I mean, really, when we think of sustainability, we think things should stay the same. And back in the 1950s, almost no fish was going into the fish meal industry. Today, one in every three fish, 36% of all fish, being ground up and turned into fish meal. So it's not in any way sustainable. It's definitely a bit out of control, and we should not keep doing it if we want to have wild fish for the future.
And there's more going into the farm animals than, for example, sushi eaters in Japan, I hear?
Exactly. I mean, when you look at the global market, it's astonishing. Pigs and chickens around the globe are eating two times the amount of seafood as Japan. They're eating six times more seafood than America, even with our red lobsters and cruise ships. So it's hard to fathom, really, just how perverse this factory farming system is, but it really pretty bad for the oceans.
Well, for those who don't know, longtime fisheries researcher, and I'd say expert, Dr. Daniel Pauly is your mentor, and he's been mine too. But he's been extremely gloomy about the future of fish. In fact, his September 2009 article in the New Republic magazine is called "The End of Fish." Is it really that bleak?
Well, I've learned from the best, as he said, so I'm afraid it is that bleak, unless we manage to sort of act quickly and act responsibly. And this requires a little bit of restraint, which humans have never been good at. But definitely we could turn things around if we just decided we wanted to close a bit more of the oceans to fishing, to remove some of the harmful fishery subsidies, government money that keeps fishing boats out there on the water when they shouldn't be, and just started enforcing some of the good legislation that we have on the books.
Can you tell us the title of your new work and where it's published?
Our new article is Conserving Wild Fish in a Sea of Market-Based Efforts. That's what it is. The title changed a bit from our original writing to the publication. And it's in the journal Oryx, which is the International Journal of Conservation.
How do you spell Oryx?
O-R-Y-X.
Okay, people can look that up if they want to. And I gather your paper adds a dimension of what actions work and maybe an evaluation of consumer market campaigns. I mean, obviously, if we can get people to stop eating the most endangered species, that doesn't stop this big conveyor belt going from the ocean to the farm feedlots. So what do we do?
I think you have it exactly right. I mean, what we are sort of saying in this article is that a lot of effort and money is going into trying to get consumers to change the way they consume fish, which is okay, but it's simply not going to work at the speed and the scale that we need it to. So when you as a consumer are going through the supermarket, you may be doing your best to make the right decisions. But when pigs and chickens around the globe are eating six times more seafood than Americans, how is any one American's decision going to make a difference? And that is really our point. So we'd rather see the efforts focused higher in the demand chain. If you want to hassle somebody, hassle your restaurant or your Costco, your Whole Foods or your Capers to do something different. We'd rather see consumers engaging more as citizens than simply as consumers with a supermarket basket, because it's not going to lead to, these large-scale changes that we need.
Well, I think I really agree with you on that one. You know, jumping to a different point, it used to be hell getting information out of ocean experts, I can tell you, even when the research was paid for by the taxpayer. Now, at least a few scientists have a career path with nonprofit groups. I notice your funding came from the Pew Institute for Ocean Science. But also, you have a blog where you can express yourself pretty freely on a lot of issues, and that seems maybe natural to younger people, but for longtime investigators like myself, it's a miracle. Do you feel that scientific freedom of expression still needs to grow more?
Well, in a way, it needs to grow more, and in a way, it needs to grow very cautiously, because one thing that is so revered in science, obviously, is the peer review process, the fact that the study that came out of ours was vetted by four scientists who are experts in our field, which is really, and then there are nine authors on the paper, so it has some weight, whereas a blog, you know, goes through no editing process. It's sort of very free, and sometimes those two mediums are confused by the general public. You know, you publish a blog, you publish a paper, and they simply aren't the same thing. So I would like to see the freedom of expression grow. It's a wonderful thing to have scientists communicating directly with the public, but it's also requires a bit more discerning on the public's part because they don't carry the same weight, I don't believe.
Right. Is it a blog or is it a peer-reviewed paper? They're very different animals.
Yes, exactly.
The other big jump I've noticed, though, is more activism from scientists. Your blog is at scienceblogs.com/guiltyplanet, and it takes people to edgy Greenpeace campaigns that sometimes criticize big corporations. Is the increase in activism, and I'm not just talking about yourself, I've seen in a lot of climate scientists as well, is it coming from greater worry about the state of our oceans for the marine scientists?
I think Daniel Pauly, who you referenced earlier, really put it best to me when he said, you know, I turned to conservation because my lab was burning down, and if it was gone, what was I going to study? And so through the data, he's realized fisheries are really in trouble, and if we don't work to turn it around, there is no future for fisheries scientists. And that's why scientists are getting involved, for the very, very selfish reasons oftentimes, because their jobs hinge on having these animals or the atmosphere existing in a relatively stable state to have, you know, any sort of future.
Yeah, well, I see you're planning a joint panel with Greenpeace for the 2010 meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science down in San Diego. Can you tell us what you're planning for that?
You're very, very on top of it. I just put that up yesterday. Yes, I'm hosting a panel on what reputation and cooperation can do for conservation. And I'm organizing that with John Hocevar at Greenpeace USA because I love everything Greenpeace does, or they love everything I do, but because they're one of the very few groups using reputation in the marketplace to catalyze change. And this goes back to evolutionary theory and conservation theory, and so we're teaming up because, as I mentioned, we'd rather see people engaging as citizens, and we'd rather see them hassling further up their supermarkets or their restaurants rather than just worrying about themselves. And Greenpeace actually is putting that to work. They have a campaign that ranks supermarkets. They've had it in Canada. They've had it in the U.S. They have it in several other countries around the world. They rank supermarkets. They give them passing or failing grades. They give them tons of good media if they're good, bad media if they're bad. And they're affecting their reputation, and then they're going back and doing it the following year and the year after that. And they're using those supermarkets' reputation. They're pushing on them to get them to engage more with sustainable seafood and improve their buying practices. Rather than just pushing on a household, they're actually pushing on these big entities. And I really like that work. I support it from a theoretical and practical perspective, and we're going to bring in some theoreticians from the evolutionary biologist side to talk about that as well.
I'm going to be talking with salmon aquaculture campaigner Catherine Stewart of the Living Ocean Society, but can you briefly tell us how you see fish farming using up these wild ocean stocks?
Well, one in every three fish taken out of the ocean is turned into fish meal. As I mentioned, 36%. Half of that goes to pigs and chickens, oddly, and the other half go to farm fish, which kind of makes sense. If you're farming fish, fish eat fish, they would need some fish meal. So what we would suggest as a large market shift, we would rather see the market supporting herbivorous fishes or herbivorous aquaculture, things like mussels and scallops, than these large carnivorous floating hog factories, Dr. Pauly's called them, along, for instance, the BC coast, that require actually more fish as inputs than they produce.
And there's fish you can raise in ponds that, as you say, feed on algae or plant life that are far less harmful to the overall environment.
Exactly. We'd rather see that consumers and policy were pushing the market in that direction.
We're talking with ocean scientist Jennifer Jacquette from the University of British Columbia in Canada. Based on your research, I know you've talked about this a little bit already, but I'm hoping you'll expand on it, on what we should be doing to save what's left of the world's fish stocks.
I think that we should be putting aside, we say at the Fisheries Center, and this is basically almost every faculty member here and postdoc like myself, we'd like to see 20 to 40% of the oceans set aside as no-take or marine protected areas. There are some disagreements over how much of that should be no-take, but right now less than 1% of the ocean is protected from overfishing. So on land, we've protected 12% of land. That's just crazy to think in the oceans there's almost no protection. And Rashid Zumaila, who's a co-author on the paper and the fisheries economist here at the Fisheries Center, is pushing hard to expose the amount of harmful fisheries subsidies, government money, that keeps fishing boats out on the water far past when they're profitable. So we would, as a policy recommendation, we would like to see that those harmful fisheries subsidies be removed in favor of free market principles, but also in favor of marine biodiversity.
As you know, the departing President George Bush created some important new marine protected areas, but those are out in the Pacific. But I learned from your Guilty Planet blog again that Obama has announced he won't create any more. What places closer to the U.S. should be protected first? Do you have some ideas on that?
Well, Obama did say he wouldn't protect more, which was unfortunate, but he might expand some of the existing marine protected areas. And he, one of his ideas is to expand the one up in Alaska, I think, off the Bering Strait, and that would be an excellent idea for lots of reasons, but mainly because that region is doing pretty well, and it's good to protect things while they're fairly pristine. So I would fully support the expansion of almost any marine protected area, and part of the work that we do here in the Sea Around Us project is to look at what areas would be would benefit most from protection. So maybe we'll be able to give you more insight to that in a year or so.
Good. We'll look forward to that. And I want to get into just sort of an opinion piece, I think, that you published in Seed Magazine of the new autobiography of the famed ocean explorer and TV personality Jacques Cousteau. That's dated November 3rd, 2009 at seedmagazine.com. Now, I'm a person who grew up looking at the underwater world with Cousteau, and it shocked me that younger ocean researchers have hardly heard of the man. Is that true?
I'm speaking from firsthand experience, it is true, unfortunately, and that was a real mystery to me. Why haven't I heard that much, and more importantly, why haven't I barely seen anything he's done? And the reason, I think, is as I mentioned in my book review, the fact that his legacy has sort of been left in shambles by a large family feud. And again, this sort of goes back to what we were talking about with reputation and how your name or your organization can live on. And it really requires a lot of cooperation, including among family members.
I think Cousteau will come back when the copyright laws let him in the estate, as you say, and that's some of the only widely known footage we have of the former richness of the sea compared with today, and that's important for that shifting baselines concept that comes out of your institute. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, so shifting baselines, again, was an idea posed by Daniel Pauly in 1995, the idea that every generation becomes sort of accustomed to a degraded state as being natural. So people out there, especially young people, would say, oh, the ocean looks great. I mean, there are lots of hammerheads swimming around or in the Galapagos Islands when I went diving, but they don't recognize that there used to be a far greater abundance because they don't have a historical perspective. And what you said about Cousteau having old footage is exactly right. He has footage from the 1940s in black and white from the Mediterranean, which is really astonishing, very cool. And that same area shot again in the 70s. And he really touched on this idea of shifting baselines with visuals and was very much a proponent of it. But again, that you said that footage has all been locked up with this family feud and it's not making its way into the public anymore.
Well, the shifting baselines, you know, I was at a dinner party with Dr. Suzuki and someone told about going back to find their nephew heading out to Lake Ontario during the summertime. And, of course, he has to put on his wading shoes and then he can go down to the shore. And I was there as a young man and it was just bare feet only. And the difference is the zebra mussels that have invaded the Great Lakes. So there's the shifting baseline where the young person growing up today thinks, well, this pollution or these odd species are normal, and they're not.
Yeah, and I think it touches on why you said, you know, Dr. Pauly's piece is kind of bleak in the New Republic, but older people naturally are more pessimistic because they have this historical perspective. Of course, things can also improve, and some people would, in L.A., for instance, would remind you that 20 years ago you could barely breathe, and air pollution has gotten so much better in L.A. thanks to good legislation, so Sometimes things do get better, and we have to remember that as well.
Well, if we give the ocean a chance, for sure, it can regenerate a lot of life. We're hoping that we're heading for some nurseries that will protect what we've got left rather than just having a sea full of jellyfish, and that has been one of the predictions if we just keep going the way we're going, isn't it?
Yes. Again, just another thing here from the Fishery Center, but jellyfish being the future of seafood, it's kind of unappealing, kind of strange, and captures the imagination in some bizarre sense. But we hope to not get entirely to that state. However, jellyfish harvests do seem to be on the rise, and there's growing market demand for jellyfish. So, well, we shall see.
Yeah, I really want my jellyfish and chips, and not so much. Was Jacques Cousteau, do you think he was too extreme when he predicted that some deserts would develop on the seafloor?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, we see there have been research from other labs. Jane Lubchenco now, who's the head of NOAA under Obama, she does a lot of work with dead zones, showing that they're increasing on the rise around the world, and the largest one being in the Gulf of Mexico at the mouth of the Mississippi River where all that nitrogen comes off. And they're creating exactly what you were saying, sort of deserts in the ocean of lifeless areas. And of course, there's some life like jellyfish and bacteria that will thrive there, but nothing like what once existed.
Well, what's next for you, Jennifer, when it comes to research?
Maybe this is bleak as well, but I think I'm going to diversify out of fisheries a bit and into conservation dilemmas as a whole, because with fisheries, well, let's just say that the solutions are sort of there. All we need is the policy and the cooperation, and the science over the next 50 years will be more or less interesting depending on the choices that are made. So I'm hoping to get more into sort of the psychology of conservation and making, how do we create that cooperation and encourage it on a broad scale for climate change, overfishing, freshwater issues, all of these sort of broad common property resource issues.
Yeah, we need some answers. Why don't we change? We've got the science. We know what's going on, but we just keep on dragging everything we can get out of the sea and leaving not much.
I think that's the interesting question. Exactly.
Our guest has been one of the new generation of marine scientists, Jennifer Jacquet from the UBC Fisheries Center. Just Google Guilty Planet blog to find her online. I've bookmarked it as a lively place to keep up to date with ocean issues. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find this interview and more about the oceans at our website, ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
This is KKGN, Green 960 AM, San Francisco. Don't forget the Monterey Bay Aquarium has the lowdown on what fish to eat and which ones to avoid. Their website is great at montereybayaquarium.org. Last week, a song from Imogene Heap wowed the crowd on TV, So You Think You Can Dance. Here's Imogene's greenside, simply called Earth.
You're not golden, and I'm getting tired. Act like you own the place when really you've only just arrived. I caught first glimmers in hides and skins. Look who's all grown up, black swanning about the solar winds. You're gonna lose it all and find yourself on your knees. So get a grip and you might flow, reverse the great slow bleed. I've tried patience, but you always want a war. This house won't tolerate anymore. Stop this right away. Regardless, this is not a fire drill, and if we hold any hope, it's harmonic connection in stereo symbiosis. These Legoland empires